History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Many of the guests on this podcast have been book authors and history professors, and they're all fantastic. But some of my favorite moments have come from people who approach history in an unconventional way. For example, the lead singer of a Swedish heavy metal band who releases a concept album about World War I, or in the case of today's episode, the owner of a distillery who found multiple casks of brandy that date back to the period of Napoleon III in France and want to make history something that you can literally taste. And this approach really makes a lot of sense if you think about it, because some of the most remarkable historical artifacts found in the possession of collectors aren't necessarily pieces of art, but they're vintage wines or spirits. A rare bottle's journey can span continents and centuries and be older than any human alive. Today's guest is Raj Bhakta. He's the founder of Whistle Pig, a maker of one of the world's most popular rye blends of whiskey, and he's also an entrepreneur with a gift for promotion, including being a contestant on season 2 of The Apprentice and riding an elephant across the Rio Grande River in 2006, accompanied by a 12-piece mariachi band when he was running for a U.S. congressional seat in Pennsylvania. Well, after all that, he founded Whistle Pig, and then during a recent trip to France, by an incredible stroke of fortune, he was able to purchase 38 barrels of Armagnac vintage brandy, with some barrels dating back to 1868, right on the eve of the Franco-Prussian Wars. Recently, he released Bhakta 50, an age blend of 8 rare Armagnac vintages dating between 1868 and 1970, which are then finished in whiskey casks. In this episode, we're going to discuss how valuable items can last the test of time, the local character of brandy versus whiskey, where brandy is inherently something that is locally produced and has to do historically with an association with the villager, while whiskey is connected with grain and it has to do more with the farmer, so we have things like the Whiskey Rebellion in early American history, and also discuss why craftsmanship is still needed in the 21st century today, even though some would think it's rendered unnecessary by industrialization. We also discuss how amazing it is that historical artifacts can last a long period of time. In the case of the vintage brandy he found, every village in France had been sacked time and time again, and when a town is captured, alcohol is one of the first things to be consumed. In fact, the oldest inhabitants of the Armagnac region still recall the sight of German scout planes circling the countryside, searching for the telltale black discoloration, which is a byproduct of alcohol storage, which appeared on the side and roofs of the cellars of the villagers who had hidden their brandy stocks. So this is an unconventional approach to history in this episode, but I really enjoyed this discussion, and I hope you do in this talk with Raj Bhakta. Raj, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Scott.
There are so many things we can talk about. We can talk about Napoleon III. We can talk about forests in France that were designed to create a gigantic French imperial fleet, but instead went to barrels. We can talk about the difference in flavor profiles between brandy and whiskey. But I suppose a good place as any to start is when you cross the Mexican border with a mariachi band playing in the background on an elephant. So border security must have been sparse in the area. But can you please, let's start off with that story. How did that come about, and what was that like?
Let's see. Elephant mariachi band. So I'm running for Congress, 29, 30 years of age in suburban Philadelphia. I am running as a Republican in a Democrat district. I had just gotten fired off of the biggest TV show at the time, which is The Apprentice, led by our illustrious former president, Donald Trump. And my name is Raj Bhakta. So you got Raj Bhakta, Republican reality TV star running for Congress, and the newspapers in Philadelphia were not writing good stories about him. And it's a huge, you know, Democrat wave coming on that year. So basically, I need some sort of like Hail Mary pass to break me. I can't afford an expensive advertising campaign or broadcast campaign in the fourth most expensive media market in the country. So I got to think of like, how am I going to get some attention on my race on a popular issue? So surprising in all the polling comes that the border security is an important issue to the voters of the 13th congressional district in Pennsylvania. So as I wrote in my book, which comes with the brandy that we'll talk about, that an entire bottle of tequila helped me like conceive of this idea of taking an elephant across the Rio Grande. I'm drinking with a couple of buddies and I'm thinking like, what am I going to do? What are we going to do, you know, to break into the news? You know, I tried so many different tricks to get in. I can't get any attention to my campaign. I'm in a full media blackout, right? And so what if we border security? What can we do around border security? What if we took, like, I took a horse across the border, or I marched across the border, and then I came up with like an elephant. What if I took an elephant, if I just marched across the U.S.-Mexico border on an elephant, recorded it, right? That would have to get some attention. This is how open our border is. People didn't realize that. By the way, this is in the backdrop of like we're fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan in the name of national security. And literally, you could take an elephant across the border. It struck me as a little particular noteworthy. So elephant then became elephant with mariachi band. So that's the background to that. I took an elephant heralded by a mariachi band, very Hannibal-esque, Scott, Hannibal-esque, and invaded the United States. And I still lost the damn race, but which got me into the whiskey business.
Well, I don't know if you rented the elephant on the U.S. or Mexican side of the border, but I would imagine crossing an international one would violate the terms of the rental. So did you by chance lose the deposit that you put on the elephant rental?
Actually, you know what? I wonder how the elephant rental market is today. There was a guy from Barnum and Bailey, like they have subcontractors for elephants, but American elephant out of Louisiana. By the way, the elephant nearly like vanished into the Rio Grande. I thought for a while. My campaign manager came up to me and he goes, "Raj, you see that over there? That's Mexico. That's where you're going to have to run for Congress if this elephant doesn't come out of the river." So got the elephant back. Didn't lose any deposit. But in the middle of it, Scott, here's an interesting tidbit. I realized that my mariachi band, I'm running on like a border security, you know, ticket, Republican candidate. My mariachi band that somebody arranged from there is all illegal, right? And that border security was on the way. So I'm like hurrying up to finish this, filming this stunt of coming across the elephant while at the same time trying to like get the shot so I could get the mariachi band out so they didn't get, you know, busted. And this turned into, you know, a press nightmare for me. But it was a very interesting day and probably my most, you know, memorable moment in the year of 2006 by far.
All right. Well, mariachi bands. I know I read a book on the early days of SpaceX with Elon Musk, and he always marked important events with mariachi bands. So there's something to it. Well, that is no natural way to pivot to the next subject. So I'll just jump right into it. What we're talking about specifically with you on the show is a piece of history that you have engaged with deeply, and that is 38 barrels of Armagnac that you recently purchased, and they form the basis of a new brandy of yours. And I suppose let's begin with the history of them, because you, in preparation of this interview, looked at the background of Napoleon III. So I think it's only fair that you be able to discuss that. So what is the genesis of these 38 barrels that form the basis of your new brandy?
Yeah, so I've been in the spirits business for over a decade now. I started a company called Whistlepig, which is now a, you know, probably the top American luxury whiskey brand. But around 2017, I began looking at, you know, literally the world over for what are other opportunities actually inside whiskey. And I found whiskey to be oversaturated, overhyped with the resultant basically high prices for low quality that I was seeing in a lot of cases. Even if it was high quality, the prices were just through the roof, right? And I started touring the world, and I found a treasure trove, a real historical treasure trove in the Armagnac region of France. This was the area of the old Dukes of Armagnac, who were far away in the southwest of France from the king, troublesome folks, at least from the king's perspective. And sort of an insular region and this product never got exported. So I found this chateau owned by a family that had been collecting the Armagnacs from the late 1800s. And they had had a collection nearly seamless collection that go back to 1868. And when I think of whiskey, you know, you got a 10-year-old whiskey's old, an 18-year-old whiskey's very old, a 25-year-old whiskey's ancient, you know, 25-year Macallan is $3,000 a bottle. I saw this spirit that went back to 1868 and my jaw just dropped, right? I mean, you know history. I love history. I was thinking about it. My God, you know, the oldest stuff in this chateau, Napoleon III was emperor of France. The Queen Victoria was in the middle of her reign. You know, we had just come out of the Civil War. And we had all the World War I vintages, the World War II vintages. I'm like, it's a miracle. Truly, it's a miracle that these spirits exist. And I had never seen anything like it. It took me a couple of years to buy the chateau. I mean, you know, when your jaw drops and it's just, there's no way of concealing, like when you see a beautiful woman or something like that, there's just no way of hiding your being impressed. The same thing happened to me when I was looking at the stuff, and the seller, who was a bit of a pain in the ass, saw it, and you know, he got all the money. And I bought the largest chateau, I mean, the largest collection of ancient, of old spirits on the planet. And we're releasing it barrel by barrel. The first release, which is in 2020, 2021, is 38 barrels. And it's a blend of Armagnacs that range from 1868 to 1970. So from 153 to 51 years old. It's the oldest, rarest, most exquisite spirit on the planet. And, you know, I think we're giving it away, which I fear, you know, I sometimes wonder, I was like, does this show like low self-esteem or something like that? But it's an absolute steal, like $400 a bottle, which may sound, some may find incredulous, but given what it is relative to whiskey, it's an absolute, you know, bargain and steal to drink a piece of history with an average age of, you know, middle 60s. And for a taste profile that, I mean, you know, you don't have to be an aficionado. You tasted it. What did you think?
So we were talking about this on air beforehand, and I drank it since I'm not someone who has a sophisticated palate. If we were drinking it now, I think, that's good in ways that I can't really describe, but I detect nuance. So I really appreciate brandy, because something you write about in the book is that it has a sweet profile, the way that wine can carry nuance in a way that whiskey, if you're just harvesting tons and tons of grain, people don't really talk about grain vintages. Something else, you know, at the end, there's a peppery finish, which I like that too. So does that come from one of the barrels?
Yeah. So you get what I like to say about Bacta is it combines some of the best elements of the brandy world with the best elements of the whiskey world. So you've got, you know, it's got the spice of a rye whiskey. It's got the creaminess and the sweetness of a bourbon. And it's got the spice of an Isla, of a fantastic scotch. And you combine those, you know, that triumvirate of goodness from the whiskey world and combine that with the elements of nuance and delicacy that you get from really great brandies. And you've got a spirit when you combine the two. Because I'll add here that I finish them in the whiskey casks, which I'll talk more about in a moment. But it is basically a combination of two worlds, which is better than either of them independently. So it's, you know, it's a 2+2=5 situation, which results in the best spirit in the world. And the amazing thing to me here, Scott, is that this never got discovered. This never got, you know, basically sent out to the outside world, and it never got, you know, captured in the three German invasions that happened in France between 1870 and 1940, right? I mean, this is an insane, you know, when this area was never heavily sacked in France, but still, you know, the first thing that soldiers look for when they occupy a place, they look for booze, and then they, you know, terrorize the local populace in ways you can imagine.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because one thing you note is that, and when I say you note, there's a little booklet that comes with these bottles that...
A fantastic booklet. That's a great booklet, isn't it, Scott?
Right, yeah. So there's one point where you say that the oldest inhabitants of the region recall the sight of German scout planes circling the countryside, searching for telltale black discoloration, which is a byproduct of alcohol storage that appears on the side and roofs of cellars.
Right.
And it's this is something that it's a timeless challenge of taking valuables and securing them multi-generationally before you have banks and safe deposit boxes. So if you look at the history of monasteries and their most sacred relics, if they're on the coast of Ireland or Normandy, they've had frequent Viking incursions and raids and sackings. Relics of churches in Asia Minor or Constantinople, many of those were carted off by crusaders in the Fourth Crusade. So today they're not in Constantinople, they're in Italy. So when you don't have safe deposit boxes, storing something of value multi-generationally it's a challenge. So maybe this is where myths come from of, you know, secret orders of monks or Templars or Illuminati that can secure these valuables. It's kind of this myth. So how do you think people were able to secure things so that troops from, you know, World War I Germans or World War II Germans couldn't sack? And as you noted correctly, that when a pillaging happens after a city or a town falls, soldiers will rape and loot and plunder and go through. And if you have booze, of course, they're going to get drunk and keep going. So did you get a sense of how is something secured multi-generationally of something of value when that's historically very hard to do?
I think that's a great introduction, right? And I'll just put a side note as like when you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, it's almost with a tinge of guilt might not be the right word, remorse might not be the right word, but it's, I guess, a cognizance at the very least that what I'm drinking when I'm drinking a bottle of Bacta is so remarkably ancient that I feel that, is this even right? So to get to the specifics of the point, I mean, really, it became in World War II, right? With the, because this is part of Vichy, right? The part of France the Germans left to, you know, I guess, self-administer, heavy-handed, I guess, with a heavy oversight from Germany. The Germans would send in scout planes, and whether this was, you know, on the personal recognizance of, you know, Goering's Luftwaffe, you know, daring captains trying to steal some product to bring back home, they would fly around and they would look for, you know, barns that had this, you know, sort of black sides. And what you would do, and the way the residents dealt with it there, is they would spread it out all over the place. They would put it in, you know, put barrels in hay piles, you know, and just spread it out as far and wide as possible so that if they did go barreling into those as they did, you know, the goods wouldn't be there. And as you say, this was sort of traditionally in Armagnac, which is a region out of time, really out of time. I mean, the way they distill there and wood burning stills, which I don't think has been done in any real, you know, commercial way in America for, God, at least over 100 years. You know, it's like a storybook. And this is one of those things that I just can't get over. Knowing the business, like I know, you have like, you know, people selling tequila, you have people selling now mezcal, right? Which is a craft Mexican spirit, which is brand new stuff. I mean, it's right off the still. It doesn't cost much to make. It's smoky and frequently not very good. When you get a great mezcal, it's good, but you get a lot of bad mezcal. The here is something that cost 5-10 times more to make than mezcal, and that is over a century old. So why did this keep secret get stuck? It's sort of mystery upon mystery to me, you know, knowing business, because there were businessmen in the area. I guess they were just bad marketers. They didn't have much hustle. They were a little too fat and happy to begin with. They had this sort of provincial mentality of just, you know, keeping it in the area. I don't understand it. And then the sheer luck of, I mean, and the discipline it takes, by the way, from a business standpoint, not to monetize any of this stuff, not to sell it in 153 years. It just blows me away. And that's what, you know, that's what you're able to buy in a bottle of Bacta.
Yeah, it sort of becomes self-perpetuating that somebody has a original card in plastic, but they won't open it because it's original and just goes on and on and on.
Right.
So this is telescoping out a little bit, but I guess we're going to get into the philosophy of different drink styles, but because you've worked on these, you would be well-equipped to answer them. So I've had a lot of personal experiences with brandy, and you know, I would say I have a soft spot in my heart for them. I was in Hungary for a few years, and once you get into the villages, almost everyone will have homemade brandy. That's because in their garden, they'll have some fruit trees.
Do they call it Schliebowitz? What do they call that in Hungary?
Palinka.
Palinka, yeah, mm-hmm. yeah.
And then other, yeah, so there's different words all over the place in the Balkans, but it's mostly the same thing. And they would have their own fruit trees, but most people wouldn't distill it themselves. There would be a local distillery at the village level. So that makes place on economies of scale, that everyone distilling on their own doesn't really make sense, but it works better on the local level where they can just bring in the fruit, it's distilled, they get it back. So anyone you talk to, will anyone, if not themselves, will have an uncle or a father that they'll gladly give you a 2-liter bottle or 1-liter bottle of Coca-Cola with the label torn off and that of their homemade drink. And an office mate of mine who is Macedonian, I asked him about this. And he, of course, a couple weeks later after he visited home and came back, had some that he brought. So that's, it seems like brandy, it's really tied to the local level. But then when you get to things like whiskey, it's tied to grain, which we have the Whiskey Rebellion in early American history. That's scaled up to the level of a farmer. And then scaled up even higher, you have rum, which was the drink of the colonies, which is tied to large sugarcane plantations and slavery in the Caribbean and all that different stuff that requires massive manpower. How do you see different types of drink tied to different types of levels? Is brandy quintessentially a local crafted drink just by its nature versus other drinks? Or so anyway, I leave you the floor open to enumerate on the different characters of different drinks based on my kind of roundabout explanation. Well,
that's a very interesting question, and it's one that I'll give you credit for not having been asked before. Is brandy inherently a craft small scale spirits category or spirit? I can answer that historically, certainly in Europe, yes, right? There has, with one exception, which is cognac, certainly in the old, you know, lands of Habsburg monarchy and the Danube Basin in Austria and the Balkans, you know, very small scale, very rustic. And, you know, the only real standout to that, and by the way, let's add this. Brandy is basically is a spirit made from any fruit, right? So that can be peaches, plums, and a lot of the apricots. And you get it. I mean, I had an amazing apricot brandy in Budapest, and there's a really amazing one that comes out of Austria. Apricot is probably my favorite pit fruit brandy, but the majority of it is grape. And the biggest one by far is cognac. Cognac is a big global drink, primarily with one brand behind it. That's Hennessy, the biggest of them. Armagnac is its very, very, you know, small cousin. And I would say Armagnac is more in the vein of what you were describing. So in Armagnac, you have these farmers. The farmers don't have generally their own stills. So you'd have a mobile, unlike what you were describing, the people coming in, you'd have a mobile still, which would go around and visit these different farmers and take their wine. And, you know, the Dutch called it Brentwein, burnt wine. And that would, you know, basically distill it, which is boiling it. And you capture the vapors that come off, and that's your brandy. But certainly vis-a-vis whiskey, vis-a-vis vodka, vodka is inherently industrial. Nobody, by the way, don't buy expensive vodka to any of your listeners ever. It's not worth it. I'm in the business, I know. It's basically a purely industrial product. It's tasteless and odorless, which is a good benefit in certain cases. But I think that to answer your question as succinctly now as possible, after rambling a bit, the brandy is probably the spirits category that is the most small-scale craft-like on Earth.
Another thing, too, kind of getting into the history of how drink profiles and preferences change over time. I'm curious about what you know based on how they've changed that would surprise people today. And to preface your answer, here's what I'm thinking. The idea today is that if you have a manly drink, it has to be a bourbon. You can't put ice in it. You have to drink it on the rocks. Anything else is a girly drink. But if we think of something like the history of tiki bars in America, those were started by World War II vets in the Pacific Theater who got interested in Polynesian culture. So your same guy who would drink a Mai Tai that you think that's a girly drink was going island to island with flamethrowers. Or the idea that if we imagine, oh, what did the founding fathers drink? Oh, whatever we associate as being the most manly drink, it had to be a 12% Russian imperial stout beer polished off with a you know, 80% hard alcohol when they were drinking rum. And we think of rum, that's what frat boys drink with their Captain Morgan. So our idea historically of what people would have drank, we don't really have the historical scope. Do you have ideas of how drink preferences have changed over time that you think someone who only knows a little bit, but not a lot about spirits would be surprised by? Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
That's a great question. I don't think it follows necessarily any rhyme or reason. You know, I think people just get, you have, let's call it the influencers, to use that particular term. You have, like, let's say whiskey right now. People don't wake up, and the whiskey drinkers are not waking up every morning being like, boy, I'm really, you know, sick of bourbon. But, you know, they may have tried a whole bunch of different ones of them, or, you know, tired of rye whiskey or tired of scotch. And they're just sort of, that's been there, done that. It's sort of played out as a category. It's beginning to happen. And so then what are they going to get into next? Well, what they're going to get into next is, you know, where some of the leaders of taste, what they find and what they share. So, of course, I hope it to be Armagnac. I'm not trying to bring it to Bacta, but merely to share how I think it happens. You know, I mean, it's all, why are those guys drinking those, you know, kick-ass Marines who probably saw the toughest combat the troops have ever seen in the history of mankind, you know, fighting the Japanese island to island. When they got off, they would spend a little time in that tiki bar. And that for them was probably the best memory of relaxing and chilling out with the warm and cozy hospitality of the, you know, locals. That they brought that back because that was an absolutely magical, you know, memory. So it doesn't really find. And look, I mean, look, you're talking about, you know, machismo and all that. I mean, look, we would have thought the founding fathers were wearing something like close to, you know, leotards, but they were, you know, courageous and brave. We can't doubt that now. And I wonder, you know, as we look at our reaction to the coronavirus, whether, you know, the actual level of bravery in the American people is has gone up or gone down since that time. You know, I don't know, but I don't think it's tied to necessarily drinking, you know, bourbon. It's a mystery. It's a mystery. Like, how did Armagnac remain, you know, undiscovered for all this time? And why is it that this man, Bacta, brought it forth out of obscurity?
Well, there's kind of another meta level question, but that deals with what you've been doing specifically with distillation. That a lot of what you talk about blending this is there's a lot of craft where you have somebody who is, I believe his title is Barrel Master. Is that correct?
Cellar Master.
Yeah. So
you can call him Barrel Master. I like Barrel Master.
So this is someone who will.
Barrel Master. I like that better than Cellar Master. I'm Barrel Master.
There has to be a word in German, or if not, you could invent one easily.
Barrel Meister.
That this is, we would think of this as a old world craft, somebody who knows how different types of wood from different trees impart different flavor on different types of spirits. Something that seems like would be a profession that made sense 200 years ago, but in the age of mass industrialization, doesn't make as much sense. So what I'd like you to do is ruminate a bit on what is the benefit and purpose of craft in the 21st century, where you're creating something that is not only craft in its very nature, but relies on the knowledge and skills passed down from generation to generation to generation that could very much be in danger of dying off. And when I was thinking about this question, I thought, you know, I respect a cobbler, somebody who hand makes shoes, but I've never worn a shoe made by a cobbler. I have Skechers that cost $45 that were made in a factory that made 2 million of the exact same kind of Skechers, and they cost $45 because they were made in that factory. A cobbler could have made those Skechers, but then they would have been $500. So where do you see craft like this fitting in the industrial and post-industrial world?
Well, you know, I'm going to give you credit. You're asking a number of really good questions that really get almost, you know, philosophical in nature. So why craft? What's the benefit? I think, look, I mean, we all want something special and unique, right? And something that wasn't produced, you know, with, you know, poor little Chinese children groaning under the tyranny of a communist party in that evil state. you know, we don't like the idea of buying, you know, into that and all the human suffering and the lack of individuality that's involved in that, which we do so much of today. We're looking for something different. And there's a beauty in it. There's a beauty in a multi-generational enterprise where father teaches son or daughter all that he's learned in a life and all the, and I'll tell you this, I mean, all the mystery that goes into what even for people who have been here for a while, the mystery of like, why did this barrel, you know, produce this flavor profile, which I didn't expect, which is either exquisite or bad, frankly. And, you know, all of the, all that comes along with this unexpected, non-homogenized, highly individualized, you know, production process. And since you're in history, I mean, it's, you see the, you think of these things that are being lost. We know that we're losing skills, especially as that relate to, you know, making things. And there was once a time when people in the Middle Ages, you know, looked up and would have looked at the remains of an aqueduct that the Romans had built and thought it was done by, you know, some aliens or superhumans or, you know, demigods. And that's because the knowledge and the craft, you know, was lost. And finally, for me, I alluded to my feelings regarding the communist Chinese rulership of that country. And I think that, you know, it's nice to know that things were made and were basically, this is important to me, I'm production techniques that were, you know, honed over centuries. And Armagnac is the oldest recorded spirit in the world. You know, it goes back to a papal legate. I'm going to forget his name right now. Who in the 13th century wrote back, you know, to the Pope that he found the greatest, you know, spirit that in the world. And by the way, he like wrote that it certainly like insinuates that he thought that it had cured erectile dysfunction, which is a particularity on many levels.
That sounds like a papal legate to me in the late Middle Ages right there. So
yeah.
Plenty of bastard children running around that he'll appoint to some office to, you know.
Maybe it was healthy. Church was, those were the good old days. Church was booming. You know, something that goes back so far and so deep that we're bringing to America. So to me, as a businessman, you know, I really fundamentally love the idea of bringing the best production techniques and all the knowledge to America, to my farm in Vermont, where we're planting a variety of different grapes. And we brought a still over from Armagnac, and we're going to be making it here and ensuring, you know, that the best stuff in the world is coming out of the United States of America.
Something else with that of trying to reproduce history that could perhaps get you in the mind of people who did things in a very different way. You're on a farm and you have a wood-fired still that you use instead of a gas-fired still. And I've had different guests on the show in the past who tried to recreate the experiences of their historical subject. So I had a co-host who, we did a 20-something part series on a military history of the Civil War. He's done several Civil War reenactments where he wore the uniforms, he slept in the ways they did. And I just asked him about what did it feel like? And he said, it's one thing to be sore and cold after 2 days, and that puts you in a different mind frame. Or another guest who studied mountain men and trappers and explorers in the Pacific Northwest in the 18th century. And he tried to hike and reproduce their methods as much as possible to get a sense of being in that. Or to get out of a historical example, the scientist Richard Feynman, when he was an undergraduate, reproduced a lot of the physics experiments of the 17th and 18th century and the 19th century just to get the muscle memory of a physicist then. And who knows? I mean, that's part of the reason he was such a great physicist in his own right. But did you glean anything by using antiquated methods like a wood-fired still that you thought, okay, this puts me in the shoes of somebody who was doing this in the Renaissance period or in the pre-industrial period? Did you get anything out of that, do you think?
Yeah, I can only say it's romantic. Mm-hmm. You know, to be trying to calibrate the heat of your boiler, you know, with the right size and hardness of the wood. I'm almost laughing as I'm saying it. And, you know, there's romance in it. There's, I love it. It's magic. You know, it's different than an industrial distillery. There's a guy, you know, who literally probably being paid something close to minimum wage because it takes absolutely, you know, no expertise whatsoever. It's run by computers and you have gigantic software programs and a series of boilers firing these, you know, big plants. And by the way, it produced great stuff, huh? You know, the you drink, you know, Johnny Walker is wonderful whiskey. Honest to God, is wonderful whiskey. But, you know, it's as romantic as a Camry. The which is a great car, by the way. You know, you want to drive across the planet 36 times, Camry's the vehicle.
Yeah.
The in comfort and, you know, all that stuff, really nothing against the Camry. But you get into a Rolls Royce, you get into a 1975 Corniche II, hand-stitched, hand-built. By the way, not a great car. Huh? They didn't run perfectly when it was new, but it's just a full experience in it. Now, unlike the Rolls, and I'm important, you know, it's important to underline it, the product that comes off the still that's made from the grape, made from wine, is truly, truly exquisite. And I just want to add, you know, point there, because there are probably some whiskey drinkers and spirits drinkers on here that work that are curious about the age. A bourbon doesn't age well after really 15 years, maybe even earlier, maybe a little later, depending on the type of wood, depending on the thing. But I'm generalizing because we must to know anything. The Scotch, you know, can age maybe another 10, 20 years longer than bourbon. But Armagnac can age, and this goes to the quality piece. You're getting that rare combination of romance and age and everything with a product that's still absolutely, you know, exquisite in Bacta. And that is a really, really surprising thing, because I go back to, you know, this 1868 vintage we have. And when I taste it, frankly, it was sublime, you know, and that's because they, in Armagnac, the aging process, they pull it out of wood between, you know, 35 and 70 years in that range. And it goes into glass, and then it mellows in the glass. So you have the oldest spirits in the world, which are uniquely also, you know, exquisite, and that were made in the most romantic, exactly how you would want the best tasting spirit in the world to be produced, like the very picture of it.
Before I ask a question, kind of like tying in all these things together, there's a historical anecdote that I really love, where the wood that produced the barrels that you made were from trees that were planted for France's plans for world domination that never happened. So this is a wonderful historical dead end, or cul-de-sac, I guess you could call it, or maybe a happy accident for your purposes. But where did all those trees come from? I love that story. Hey, everyone. Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Yeah, so the Sun King, Louis XIV, whose ambitions knew no bounds, who was also very talented, I should add, and who had a very talented team. He had this economics minister named Colbert. And Colbert put together France's, you know, with a lot of state intervention, was making investments into like silk and actually a lot of the things that turned out to be France's economic, you know, drivers today, luxury goods. But he also had a plan for, you know, basically being the predominant power in the world, which required a big navy, and navies eat a lot of oak. And so he began planting in the Limoges, in the central area of France. Maybe it wasn't heavily populated. I really don't know exactly why. Maybe they actually were fairly scientific about it, which wouldn't surprise me, and figured this was the perfect region. Started planting vast amounts of oak trees, which became state assets, actually, and remain to this day. So if you go to these, you know, oak forests, which are impeccably maintained and look very different, frankly, than an American oak forest, where we actually get a lot more. This started from the imperial ambitions of the Sun King himself. And obviously, you know, the French Navy spent more time, you know, bottled up by the British and at sea. And whenever it got out, it sort of got obliterated. So, you know, they turned into barrels for Armagnac and cognac and wine and all that. But it was a good investment anyway. You invest really long term when you plant forests.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Another multi-generational effort, which came to be used well for purposes of cellar masters and others. So to tighten a lot of these things together, we're dealing with alcohol, which is perhaps one of the most universal of human subjects outside of warfare and prostitution, both of the subjects I've covered at length on my podcast. And the Homer Simpson quote that he said, toasts to alcohol, the cause and solution to all of life's problems. So this is something that is produced in every civilization on Earth, including, and in fact, especially those that do not allow it, just simply in an underground way. And we've talked about how different cultures and parts their, I guess, values on their different national drink, where some might be produced at an industrial scale, some might be produced at a craft scale. And to end on a positive note, at the end of your book, you write that you're trying to emblemize the spirit of revival, that people will come back facing different challenges in the case of the Spanish flu 100 years ago or after coronavirus today. And that's something that you try to capture. So looking in the past, but also forward in the future, what were ways that you were trying to capture that as you were distilling this?
Well, you know, it's I go back and I was writing the conclusion to the book, which goes with every bottle of Bock, the brandy. And it was at the height of like the coronavirus time when we didn't really know what was happening. And it was actually a little, you know, scary, let's say like mid-March to mid-April.
We were all watching Tiger King. Yeah.
Right. the of that time, you know, last year. And it was a little spooky and people were getting really down. So I wrote the following, as I write about this new product, 250 years in the making, referencing the trees that went to make the barrels, I cannot help but ponder the lessons of time. This bottle contains the finest spirits of Western civilization. Its history contains a message. The message is revival. Bacta reminds us of the indomitable human spirit, of our stunning resilience. Humanity, referencing now this plague, has gone through much worse. The coronavirus, the Black Plague, the World Wars, the Great Depression, the Spanish flu, which killed 50 million. But here we remain. This pandemic provides an opportunity, if we seek it, for an American revival and a chance to do and accomplish great things and make awesome things at home. Again, this is our mission at Bacta. Dream it, believe it, do it. And, you know, you go back and you look at the different vintages that were in the bottle. The 1868, France was up, right? France was up and Napoleon III seemed secure on the throne. 2 years later, he is surrounded and captured by the Germans at Sedan. The, you know, 1868, it was a dark time in America. We were, you know, still smoldering after the Civil War. President Johnson was being impeached. But by 1898, where there's another vintage in there, we're sort of about to become a superpower, and Teddy Roosevelt is about to lead America into a new period of strength, power, and confidence. Then you have another blend, 1934, right? The fascism is taking a hold in Europe across the board. 1941, you know, you have the America entering that war, but by 46, which is also in the vintage, you know, the clouds have lifted and Europe's rebuilding. And when you go up and down and up and down throughout the cycles of history, there's a line in this Kipling's poem, If, right? If you can meet with triumph and disaster and treat both those imposters just the same. And I think that that's what history teaches us. And that's what I take out when I think of when I drink Bacta. It's great. It's fantastic. It's delicious. It's the best stuff I've ever drank, but there's something more profound in it. You know, as I read this book and I think of the lessons of history, and that is you go where you're looking, you know, so let's look up to the broad sunlit uplands and there we shall go.
All right. Well, there's a lot more to unpack here, both in the history and the drink itself. So Raj, if people want to learn more about you, but then also Bacta online, where is the best place to go?
I just go to Bacta Brandy, B-H-A-K-T-A, Bacta, and then Brandy, B-R-A-N-D-Y, you know how to spell, D-D-Y, rather, BactaBrandy.com.
Right, not the girl's first name, but the drink. So, all right, well, I'll include that in the show notes so listeners can check that out there. Well, Raj, thank you very much for joining us and sharing all this with us.
My pleasure. Great to be here.
All right, that is all for today's episode. As a first order of business, I need to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and I'll explain what that is in a second. And they are Kristen Lee, Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Wire Meets Wood Guitars at WMWGuitars.com, Bill Ivey, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Dane Carlson from Linwood, Washington, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael Piccinetti, Michael from New York, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh Reddick, Jake Harrington, Josh from BFW Post 2285, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Frieza. Now, if you'd like to support History Unplugged and help it grow, there are three easy ways to do so. First, subscribe to the show and leave a review on the podcast player of your choice. This helps other people discover the show. Second, join our Facebook group, and here you can discuss recent episodes with fellow listeners, mention what you'd like to see on the show in the future, and get way more out of the show, and just look for History Unplugged on Facebook. Third, become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army established by George Washington, but it's also the membership group of History Unplugged, and here you can really dive in way deeper with the show. You can check it out by going to Patreon, patreon.com/unplugged. If you join at the Scout level, you get early access to new podcast episodes, and you get completely ad-free versions of the entire back catalog of more than 500 episodes. Plus, everything is neatly categorized, so if you want to listen to something about the Middle Ages and skip all the Civil War stuff or vice versa, you can easily find an old episode from 3 years ago that, if you're just looking on Apple Podcasts, would be buried in the feed. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the same stuff, but access to a growing catalog of now more than 60 premium episodes that come out bi-weekly, including a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, a series on French Foreign Legion fighters in World War I, one on Teddy Roosevelt's years in the Dakota Badlands, and a series on Nazi attempts to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Lastly, if you join the Spymaster level, you get all the same stuff as level 1 and 2, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You can choose a historical topic on absolutely anything, and I'll base an hour-long episode on it. Plus, you get a 3-pack of hardcover books. So again, check it all out by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Well, that's all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.